Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, March 30th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, we have a No King's Day special report covering the protests in both Eureka and Garberville, followed by state and national news. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Thousands of demonstrations were hosted across the country against the Trump administration on Saturday as a third round of nationwide protests called the No Kings rallies. Protests cropped up across the country, from Hawaii to New York, as the first No Kings Day since October and just as the midterm elections begin to shape up. Humboldt County saw protests down in Garberville to Eureka and up in Trinidad. Thousands gathered outside of the courthouse in Eureka, many protesters galvanized by the skyrocketing gas price seen in Humboldt, while others criticized the administration's deployment of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, in cities like Minneapolis and Los Angeles. At the protest, KMUD reporter Ryan Hudson spoke with protesters about what brought them to the streets.
What I came out here for?
Yes.
But I have to tell you that every day when I turn on my news, it's a new shocking horror. It's hard to pick any one thing. So what I can say is that I came out here because I grew up in the 1970s when America was aspiring to be better, to have civil rights for everybody, equal rights for all. We never got there, but we were aspiring then. We need to get there for my grandchild and for my daughter. That's why I'm here.
And to get people to register to vote.
Right.
Okay.
Because 68% of eligible voters did not vote for this. The problem is that 36.3% of eligible voters did not vote in 2024. We can fix this.
If we vote.
That was Elizabeth Kemper, a Eureka resident who attended the No Kings protest with her family. Also in attendance at the No Kings protest in Eureka was the city's mayor, Kim Burgell.
I'm not a fan of war. And I'm not a fan of people being treated like trash. So I feel like it's really important to come out with my community and stand up for that. As you can see with everybody here, I think we're all over it. We're just over it. We need to see a change.
The protest in Eureka was organized by 50501 Humboldt, which have been organizing the local No Kings protests, the U.S. out of Venezuela anti-war protests, as well as several pro-Palestine protests. Reporter Hudson spoke with 50501 coordinator AJ about the planning process and future plans with 50501 Humboldt.
I'm hoping you can just tell us a little bit about what the planning process is like. Whether or not you have to have a permit, do you try to get a permit, how do you deal with coordination with police, that kind of thing?
So there are a lot of different questions there, and I will answer them kind of in order. Mm-hmm. First of all, as for organizing, there is a lot that goes into it, specifically with the permits. Luckily, in Eureka, we don't officially need a permit for events like this, just because we're using the county space. We're not doing any real amplified noise, and we're not like entering into buildings, and we're clear of the roadway. So this is a legal, non-permitted protest. And that's also why we emphasize not going in the street so much, because that is something that needs a permit, which is a permit we can get. I was looking into possibly getting a permit for this protest to shut down Fifth Street and have a huge block party. In my conversations with the chief, since it's the one-on-one, I would need to get that permit through Caltrans, which I intend on doing for an upcoming event. It will take a lot longer and probably cost some money. So we will need to do a fundraising push, and we will also just need to be in contact with Caltrans, which is something that I would like to do in the upcoming weeks. Planning with the chief. Yeah, the chief and the Eureka police have been great with the protests in my experience. Of course, these comments are specifically related to my experiences with the chief through organizing the protests. I don't speak for anyone else or anyone else's experiences. But with these protests, the Eureka Police seem to be better than any other police department I have ever heard of. They have been very good about being there to help with traffic, to make sure that nobody is driving recklessly or endangering the protesters, whether it be speeding, swerving, blowing tires out, what have you. And also just there, you know, to make sure everything, to make sure that traffic runs smoothly. I am in contact with the chief about all these big protests, about where they're going to be. I'm in contact with them throughout the protests to try to be not only a liaison between the police and the people, but also just to like make sure everybody's on the same page and make sure that the marshals can make sure that everything's safe and not have the police doing their job. I'm referring to the 5051 Humboldt Safety Marshal Team, which I, in fact, run as well. We are trained volunteers, just regular citizens, attendees who decided to put their signs down and volunteer to go through de-escalation and safety training. And on the day of, be out there in the, you know, trademark green vests with the walkie-talkies, helping people cross the street, answering questions and making sure that everybody can walk and drive and protest safely.
Crowd number estimates for the Eureka No Kings protest range from about 3,500 people to 5,000, which is a much higher turnout than the last No Kings protest in October, which was roughly 2,500 people.
Our next big event is going to be May Day, which we will not actually be organizing. We will simply be endorsing and supporting. That will be most likely organized by the unions and the Eureka Labor Council. I think I've heard rumors that they're organizing some form of event out at the courthouse, and along with, I believe, I don't know who the other groups are. They're going to be doing an event outside the courthouse on May Day and then marching to the Eureka Theater for a showing of Inglourious Bastards. And then for 5051 Humboldt, our next big event that has not officially been announced yet, this is just a teaser, is going to be May 23rd, and that's going to be 5051 Humboldt for Palestine, which, of course, is going to be a pro-Palestine protest, and we're working on getting other groups, both locally and nationally, to be involved and endorse and have events on this day. But whether or not we do that, we're going to have a protest here in Humboldt.
Down in Garberville, the crowd number was smaller, but for the town, it was a huge turnout. About 200 people came out to Main Street in Garberville with signs and instruments in the shadow of the Patriot gas station sign that reads $6.35 per gallon.
I'm just tired of what I'm hearing and seeing, and I just wanted to be here to protest, you know? Gas prices for one, but there's other major things, and the food prices are going up. Just the stress and strain of what I see every day on the news, you know?
That was Joe Lasberry, resident of Southern Humboldt, who noticed the strain on food and gas prices during the administration. According to the USDA Economic Research Service, grocery prices have risen by 2.3% during 2025, and since the start of the conflict in Iran, gas prices have increased, with the national average at approximately $4. Here in Humboldt, which currently boasts the second highest gas price in the country at approximately $6.35. KMUN News interviewed Leggett resident Roland Stahl about his concerns with the administration.
Well, where do I begin? This stupid war is only the latest in a long string of impeachable offenses. And we have to get rid of Donald Trump. And everyone says there's no off-ramp for this war in Iran. That may be true, there are no options for Donald, but there is an off-ramp. Namely, we get rid of Donald Trump, either through impeachment, through a 25th Amendment, or I have to be careful when I say here, but if some patriot would do the needful, I can't recommend that. But one way or another, Trump has got to go. Oh, well, its effect on the whole world, on the climate disaster. I mean, I can't believe they just paid $1 billion to stop a company from building wind farms off the coast of North Carolina or New Jersey or both. I mean, it's just unbelievable what they're doing. And all these effects, as far as the effects in Humboldt County, I just noticed $6.35 for regular gasoline. I mean, that affects us.
The United States government's apparent descent into fascism was a concern for many residents, and Southern Humboldt historian Ray Raphael noted how it's similar to other moments in history.
If you could pick one thing.
One thing. The slide of the United States into fascism. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I'm a historian of the American Revolution, as mm-hmm. well as local history. And this is a cataclysmic time right now. And unless that we can stop that slide, the world is going to be much for the worse, and it already is. It's scary, and it affects every single person in the globe is being affected by this one crazy lunatic. On the other hand, he is tapping into a strain in American history that has always been present. I mean, the nativist movement, they had third-party movements in the 30s, Father McLaughlin and so on, and they would actually muster about 25 or 30% of the support. They would consider themselves nativist, you know, but, Americans only and kick everybody else out. And even the turn of the century, the movement in the cities against all the immigration. So he's an incarnation of that. The thing that has made this possible, really, to not implode is, ironically, the Internet. And there used to be something called the mainstream media that we all complained about out here in the hills. But at least the mainstream media was something that everybody could see. There was a common place in which you could debate. And now, with the algorithms bifurcated, and the only thing that you see on your newsfeed is things that you've already shown an interest in. And yeah. So it's so ironic that it's actually the internet and the particular place on the internet, which is social media, which has facilitated this takeover of our government by an absolute maniac.
The protests lasted from noon to 1 p.m., while other protests around the country went as late as 4 p.m. Here's more from the Garberville residents at the protest.
Susan Alexander, Laura Redway, been here for 46 years, and I care about what's happening. It infuriates me what I see going down, and especially people that are getting hurt by it, terribly, terribly, terribly hurt, all kinds of people, and their cities ruined, and we march through like we own the place, which we don't. And we need to take it back and make that stop. That's my main thing, is I hate what's going down for people around the world because we're of the bullies that we've become.
Prices are humongously high, and food prices haven't come down. They're extremely high in Southern Humboldt. We have, I think, some of the highest prices in the country. We don't have any competition for our stores. They're both owned by the same corporation. So a lot of people here are really hurting. Part of the Trump thing was they cut food for poor families. So institutions here that used to be able to help poor people have a lot less to be able to support hungry families. And I just find that's a travesty when we're sending billions of dollars on war and drones, and Trump's family's making billions of dollars off of the taxpayers, and it's just not right.
Well, the current administration is full of people that are actively taking away human rights and want to take away my rights as not just a woman, as a member of the LGBTQ community. I have friends that they're taking rights from. People are dying, and I'm gonna fight for as long as it takes to get things done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if it's the rest of my life. I mean, I know locally, like, there have been questions about, you know, hey, what if something happens in our small town? ICE shows up. I know we're little. It's out of there, but we have immigrants here, people who I know and love. And I know that they have family members who they're telling them, please don't come here. I might go home. Like, they may go home because it's so dangerous here. And that worries me because they make this place so beautiful. Like, the more diverse, the more beautiful it becomes here. And it makes me so upset and angry that people who, in our small town, it shouldn't affect them, and it does. Because they're having to leave. They're having to call family members and be like, hey, don't come here. Or, you know, don't visit me. Don't hop on a flight, because they don't know if ICE is going to snatch them. And it's horrifying. It's horrifying. I have loved ones who I'm like, please tell me if police pull you over, because they're people of color. And it worries me. It worries me deeply.
Up in Trinidad, the No King's Day crowd numbered to around 400 to 500 protesters. Nationally, there were more than 3,300 protests, with some estimates numbering over 8 million participants nationally. The next No King's protest is anticipated to be on May Day of this year. In state news, Latino activists worry about dust, heat at California mega solar projects. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
West Fresno County will soon be home to multiple huge solar projects, but locals want to make sure they address community concerns. The San Joaquin Valley is well known for oil and gas development, but is now seeing more industrial-scale solar and battery storage projects as the state works toward 100% clean energy by 2045. Angela Islas with the Central California Environmental Justice Network says the potential impacts need to be carefully considered.
The research is very unclear whether solar panels to this magnitude contribute to rising temperatures and exposure to valley fever, because dust is an issue.
Valley fever is a respiratory infection caused by breathing in fungus spores from dust. Islas says she'd like to see state and local agencies work with the companies to control air pollution and reduce energy bills in the surrounding low-income communities. The Westlands Water Agency approved the 130,000-acre Valley Clean Infrastructure Plan in December. The California Energy Commission approved the 9,500-acre Darden Solar Project in June. That project's owner signed a community benefits agreement promising $2 million over the next 10 years for local nonprofits dedicated to food security, clean air, and affordable housing. Pedro Hernandez with the group Green Latinos says large-scale energy projects must be implemented fairly.
There's a lot of potential for advancing California's climate goals, but also potential for increasing impacts on Latino communities. This is going to set a benchmark for how California can address the moment we're facing.
The Darden Clean Energy Project will include more than 3 million solar panels. The developer estimates the project will generate $232 million for the county over the next 10 years and will create 16 permanent jobs and 1,200 temporary positions during construction. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Guardian report shows 77% of migrants in ICE detention have no criminal convictions. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Following the Trump administration's unprecedented immigration enforcement, reports have shown that immigrants with no criminal record now make up the largest group in ICE detention. But a new investigation by The Guardian reveals a stark gap between the administration's rhetoric and the reality on the ground.
If you want data from the government, you are going to have to sue them.
That was Will Kraft, a data editor at The Guardian, who says that despite barriers put in place by the Department of Homeland Security to limit access to real-time data, his team worked to obtain government records to better understand the broader impact of immigration enforcement. Through a court challenge with press freedom lawyers, The Guardian obtained I-23 forms, a federal document that offered key details into who ICE was targeting.
I-213 forms are the records that the government uses to prove in court that a person is in the country illegally. That means that after a person is apprehended or entered into ICE detention through a bunch of different pathways, the government will file this form in court to basically tell the immigration judges that, hey, this person here, they are deportable, and this is why we believe that they're deportable. So the information on these forms is what the government has available to them to try to prove, you know, the facts and figures of the deportation case.
And what The Guardian uncovered contradicts official rhetoric about who is being targeted and detained.
77% of people did not have a criminal conviction.
And as for the so-called worst of the worst,
less than 1% were for homicide. What the data shows pretty conclusively is that the vast majority of people that are being targeted for deportation right now do not have criminal convictions. And even the people who do have criminal convictions are really hard to argue that it's a violent criminal conviction.
Among the 23% with a record, Kraft says nearly half were tied to nonviolent traffic or immigration violations. Notably, 9% in custody had convictions for assault. But Ruth Gomberg, an immigration scholar at Loyola University in Chicago, says that number can be misleading.
For non-U.S. citizens, an aggravated felony is anything that carries a potential sentence of a year or more in jail. So like what for a U.S. citizen could be a misdemeanor can be classified as an aggravated felony for non-citizens. And so, you know, you ask, well, who are all these aggravated felons roaming our streets? It's oftentimes, it's, you know, people who've been deported, who've come back to be with their family members. It's people who have these really minor records. And those are the people who are counted as aggravated felons. I'm not even talking about the vast majority who don't have any criminal record at all. So, you know, this language about criminalization, we have to be really, really careful when we say things like we want to get rid of the felons and not the grandmas. Oftentimes, they're the very same people.
For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
In National Native News, Jill Freitas reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Lawmakers in Washington are proposing to update a key housing law for tribal nations as communities across Indian country continue to face severe housing shortages. Last week, Montana Congressman Troy Downing introduced the American Housing and Self-Determination Modernization Act. The legislation would modernize and reauthorize the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act, known as NAHASDA, which provides federal funding for tribal housing programs, but it has not been fully reauthorized in more than a decade. Downing said in a press release that, quote, homeownership is the foundation of the American dream that doesn't stop with Americans in our tribal communities. The new act would increase funding and give tribes more flexibility to build, repair, and manage housing, Downing says. He says that across Indian country, many Native families are living in overcrowded homes with multiple generations sharing limited space. Mark Macaro, president of the National Congress of American Indians, says in a prepared statement that, quote, the time to reauthorize and modernize NAHASDA is now, end quote. Other supporters of the act, quoted in a press release, say the changes are long overdue. Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Brian Schatz of Hawaii are leading similar legislation in the Senate. Skiku is a nonprofit that brings skiing to communities across rural Alaska. This year, organizers tried something new to make the activity stick, training a village resident to be a coach. As Eliona Niden reports for the Alaska Desk, the idea is to encourage kids to ski throughout winter.
Justin River Lecton was a fifth grade student in Aniak in southwest Alaska when he learned to ski. He loved it and started going out on the river with his dogs, breaking trail, and enjoying the freedom the activity brought him.
It brought me outdoors. It took me, you know, outside to the nature, and I was just enjoying it so much.
Now, Lecton is 21 and becoming a ski coach. In February, he joined the nonprofit Skiku, which taught him how to ski and has been bringing the sport to kids across Alaska. Together, he and the Skiku team traveled to several interior villages, Grayling, Anwick, and Shagalak. The February trip culminated with a week in another community in the same region, Holy Cross, where Lecton now lives. There, he ran the show. Next winter, he will be the coach for Holy Cross kids.
They're mostly inside. You know, it'd be great to get them outside and to do something outdoors all together as a team, you know.
SkiCo has been around for more than a decade, bringing cross-country ski coaches and equipment to kids in Alaska villages. Tyler Hennigan is its executive director. He says usually after the visit, the skis go back to the closet. Hennigan says what's missing is an adult who will take the kids out
to kind of keep those communities shredding. In my mind, I have like a Jedi Padawan situation where like we can kind of have that person mentor those folks out there and really kind of hope to make something a little more sustainable too, that's really more community driven.
That's where a lectin comes in, to keep it going throughout the season. Santa Hamilton Roach says that children in her region stay active by hauling wood and working outside. But she says they don't get many chances to try themselves in competitive sports. And Roach is happy all four villages in her area are part of this project.
We're all the same people trying to live good, healthy, quality lives in our communities. And when you really see our tribes come together, we could do cool things.
The organizers say they hope to find more residents like Lekton to keep kids skiing throughout the season. In Anchorage, I am Alona Knighton.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Ryan Hudson, Suzanne Potter, Lauren Schmidt, and Jill Freitas. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.